8 is one of the easier chapters to interpret, so I think it's a good place to start. We read in verses 1 and 2, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw, that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai." Now, you can ask the question of those first two verses, was Daniel in Elam? I saw in a vision, it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. Was he there in person or only in a vision? Seems to me most likely it's in this visionary context he finds himself in this place. The place, however, is significant because Shushan was the capital of Elam. He was in Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. Shushan was the capital of Elam. In Daniel's time, Elam and Shushan were within Belshazzar's kingdom. They weren't particularly significant places. They were in Belshazzar's kingdom. But later, Shushan became the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. And it became a great city. In fact, it was a city inhabited up until the Middle Ages. It's known today as Susa. And a place where there are a lot of ruins from the height of the time of Persian rule, which would, of course, have been subsequent to time of Daniel. But the vision that he receives goes forward from Babylonian times to Persian times, even to Greek times. So this is the place in which he finds himself in this visionary situation. And then you read verses 3 to 14 of his vision. "I lifted up mine eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will, and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west over the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close into the ram. He was moved with anger against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat grew very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it grew great even to the host of heaven, and it cast some down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it continued and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking unto another, and said unto that saint who spoke, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." That's the vision that he saw. So verses 3 to 14 describe the vision. And you notice there are various animals depicted, a ram with two horns, initially, then a he-goat with a notable horn between his eyes that smites that ram and breaks the two horns. And then in verse 8, the last part, after that he-goat grows great and the great horn is broken, you read, "For it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." So you have these four notable ones arising, and then verse 9 says, "Out of one of them came a little horn that grew great." Now clearly, the animals and the horns are to be understood as a series of symbols to depict certain events. question is, what are the events? In this chapter, I don't think there's a great deal of doubt. There's some question about certain aspects or features of the chapter, but for the most part, there's not a great deal of doubt, because further on in the chapter, you have an interpretation given. We just lost our land.
Okay.
Is there a spare one there somewhere?
I think the light from, I think the ball point.
Okay. See, in 1 to 14, you have the vision of this ram and the goat. But then when we ask what it means, when you get to verses 20 to 27, you have an interpretation of the vision. Now, before getting to that interpretation, let me cover that up for the moment. There's another thing we want to look at before looking at 20 to 27, and that is verses 15 through 19, which introduce that interpretation. You have in verse 17, you read that this Gabriel, who was going to make him understand the vision, comes near. And you read, he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for the time of the end shall be the vision. The time of the end shall be the vision. So you have that expression in the latter part of 17. And then you read, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground. He touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know. Notice the last part of 19. I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. For at the time appointed, the end shall be. So at the end of 17, the time of the end shall be the vision. The end of 19, in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be. You can ask the question, what's that mean? Does all the vision relate to the end of the age? How are we to understand that expression, at the time of the end, at the last end of the indignation, at the point of time the end shall be? Now, I think that's a question to keep in mind as you look at the interpretation. I might just say here that E.J. Young suggests that what's in view with those expressions is the end of the Old Testament period. The phrase in the latter part of the indignation is the time of God's judgment on his people Israel before the establishment of the new covenant. So the end of the Old Testament period, the time before the establishment of the new covenant. But just keep that question in mind, and then let's go on to the interpretation, 20 to 27. In verse 20, you read, the ram which thou sawest, having two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. So you go back to verses 3 and 4, and you read 3 and 4 with a little more understanding. Because 3 and 4 says, I beheld this ram, had two horns, the two horns were high, one was higher than the other, the higher came up last, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. So no one could stand before this ram. It's interesting the way verse 3 says the ram had two horns. The two horns were high, but one higher than the other. The higher came up last. That suggests that Media was important before Persia was. And that fits with what we know of the history of Media and Persia. The Medians became independent of Assyria at about 631. The Persians began as an insignificant section of the Median Empire. But the Persians rose to control the Persian Empire, to control the Median Empire. And that was done largely through Cyrus, who brought Media under his control. So so many Medes were given places of responsibility in the kingdom of Cyrus. But you see, the picture there fits very well. This ram has two horns. Two horns are high. One was higher than the other. The higher came up last. And that's the Persian element of the Medo-Persian kingdom. I think I have a map here of Persian Empire. Just give you an idea of its extent. The area with those lines. See, it goes up through Asia Minor, well down into Egypt, and well up towards the east there. That's verse 20 of the interpretation. The ram which thou sawest having two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. Then we go on to verse 21. And the rough goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And you read verse 21. I might just mention before going on to that, you notice in verse 4, that ram pushed westward, northward, and southward so that no one could stand before it. And that is that's what you see there with that Persian Empire. Westward, northward, and southward. So that no beast might stand before him. And then verse 5, that he goat from the west, which verse 21 identifies as the king of Greece. See, verse 5 says, as I was considering, behold, the he goat came from the west over the face of the whole earth, touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns and ran into him in the fury of his power. Alexander attacked the Persian Empire. Alexander, of course, coming from Greece, and was able to destroy it. And you notice verse 5 says of this he-goat that he came from the west over the whole face of the earth, and he touched not the ground. He touched not the ground, an indication of the rapidity of his conquest. It's very swift. And then verses 6 and 7 describe the way in which Alexander took Persia. He smote the ram, broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to stand before him. He cast him to the ground and stamped on him. And the he-goat grew very great, then you read in verse 8. Now, when you look at Alexander's conquest, the black line gives you an idea of the extent of Alexander's kingdom. It was a swift conquest, but involved a number of key battles. In 334, you had a battle at the river Granicus, which is right here in northern Asia Minor, the river Granicus, northwestern Asia Minor. That was the first victory in Asia Minor over the Persian forces. That was 334. 1 year later, in 333, you have the Battle of Issus, right there at the northern, where the Mediterranean turns south along the Phoenician coast. Battle of Issus. Alexander crossed the Taurus, defeated the main Persian army at Issus. That enabled him to come down the coast and take Syria, Palestine, and on into Egypt, you see. So he could come around that corner there. So a key battle, the Battle of Issus, 333. In 331, way to the east, Arbela, A-R-B-E-L-A, Battle of Arbela. He destroyed the last Persian army, won the empire, and then he moved on from Arbela towards India, went over to the Indus River. So you see, that's from 334 to 331, 3 years. He swept away the Persians. But you read in verse 8, the he grew very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And you say, what does that mean? And then you look at verse 22. And verse 22 says, now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And what you find is, historically, when Alexander was at the height of his strength, he died. So when he was strong, the great horn was broken, as verse 8 says. So you have an enormous kingdom, a powerful man. He dies very young. What's going to happen to his kingdom? He had an illegitimate child of 2 or 3 years old, so he didn't really have a suitable son to take over his throne. He had married a daughter of the king of Persia a few months before his death, and some thought maybe a child will come from that relationship. There was a lot of confusion, a struggle for power. But within a few years, what happened was Alexander's empire broke into four parts, initially into five, but even that wasn't stable, and it settled down into four parts, with several of his generals seizing large areas of his empire for themselves. And those kingdoms look something like this in 301. You have Macedonia under Cassander, C-A-S-S-A-N-D-E-R, took Macedonia. Thrace and Asia Minor initially under Lysimachus and Antigonus. Lysimachus up here, Asia Minor under Antigonus. And then Syria, and to the east under Seleucus, and Egypt, and to the south under Ptolemy. The rule of Lysimachus did not last long, so you basically had Seleucus, Ptolemy, Antigonus, and Cassander as the four parts. Excuse me, I said Lysimachus didn't last long. It was Antigonus who didn't last long. It was Antigonus who was overthrown quickly. So you get four parts then that survived: Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. Four kingdoms, you read in verse 22, shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And then you read in verse 9, out of one of them, that is, out of one of these four kingdoms, came forth a little horn which grew exceedingly great. And he asked, what is that? And then you go over the interpretation, verse 23. In the latter time of their kingdom, that is, of those four kingdoms, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty. but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and continue, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause deceit to prosper in his hand, and shall magnify himself in his heart. By peace shall destroy many, he shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without end. So in the latter time of their kingdom, this king of fierce countenance is going to arise. In other words, it's not right at the beginning. And the question can be asked, who is in view here? Is this the Antichrist? Who is to come at the end of the age? You see, verse 17 says, at the time of the end shall be the vision. Is this the Antichrist at the end of this age? Or is there some reason to think that it is not the Antichrist? I think verse 9 is quite clear. Verse 9 says, out of one of them. And what's the them? That refers back to the four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven, the four parts of Alexander's kingdom. This person's going to rise out of one of the four parts of Alexander's kingdom. So you're in the context of Alexander's empire and its division, and a ruler coming out of one of those divisions. So I think what you have in chapter 8 is that the Lord gives a vision to Daniel to show the Lord's people that after the Persians, who had taken over Babylon in Daniel's time, after the Persians will come the Greek Empire, and that in the course of time in the Greek Empire, there's going to be a great difficulty to face. This king of fierce countenance is going to arise. And historically, we know that in this Seleucid Empire, one of those four divisions, Antiochus Epiphanes became a strong ruler. He conquered the Ptolemaic Empire, or almost conquered them. That struggle went back and forth. He magnified himself, verse 11, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. You notice his name, Antiochus Epiphanes, that Epiphanes means manifestation of God. He felt he was a manifestation of God. He viewed himself as the manifestation of Zeus, the Greek god. He wanted himself to be worshipped. And from what we know of him, he exhibited the characteristics that are described here. He stormed Jerusalem and defiled the temple. And the background for that was this. He had gone down into Egypt. He wanted to conquer Egypt. He'd gone down into Egypt and was just about to defeat the Ptolemies of Egypt, when the Romans sent a force to Egypt because they did not want these two, they didn't want the Seleucids to consolidate their power over Egyptians. It would be too major a power. And the Romans had their own ideas about controlling the Mediterranean. So they sent a force to Egypt. And this Roman general met Antiochus outside of Alexandria, and there's the story told about their encounter. They, in fact, had known each other because Antiochus had been a prisoner in Rome some time earlier and had become acquainted with this man. But this Roman general, Popilius Lanus, L-A-E-N-A-S, told Antiochus that he had to give back the area taken and vacate Egypt. And we heard a lot in this desert storm situation recently about drawing a line in the sand. I think that the origin of that expression comes from this incident, because this Roman general drew a line in the sand, a circle around Antiochus, Antiochus said he wanted time to consider the demands of the Romans. And this Roman general draws this line in the sand around him, and he says, look, you tell me before you step over that line. So Antiochus was humiliated, and he knew he didn't have the forces to fight the Romans. So he had to retreat. And when he retreated, he vented his anger on the Jews. He came into Jerusalem and defiled the temple and broke down the walls of the city, sold women and children as slaves, banned the Jewish faith. Observance of the Sabbath and circumcision forbidden on the sentence of death. The Old Testament scriptures were burned. Images of Greek gods set up in all the cities of Judah, and the Jews forced to worship them. And if you didn't do it, you were tortured or killed. So, in the temple itself, an altar was erected on which swine were offered, you know, just to antagonize the Jewish people. And the whole temple was sprinkled with fat from the offerings of these swine. There's a question that many
get. Yeah, I was just wondering how powerful Rome was. Antiochus is just about ready to devour all of Egypt.
The Romans had just defeated Macedonia, Third Macedonian War. So they had been themselves expanding eastward into Macedonia. And they must have sent a fairly powerful fleet of boats. And they just come off another victory in those Macedonian wars with the Romans. So it must have been a force, I'm not sure, you know, in numbers, but it must have been a force significant enough that Antiochus did not dare to take them on. I see our time is up. I want to look a bit further at verses 9 through 14. There's some rather obscure phrases there as we've just described it. So let's stop at this point. We'll go a bit further with chapter 8, the beginning of our next hour. In the meantime, remember,